TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Sandor Katz, Wild Fermentation. Have you ever considered the secret life of microorganisms and bacteria? The beneficial power of something we're taught to fear and fight with antibiotics, chlorine, and special soaps. In the first part of this talk, Sandor Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation, surprised us by making the case that some bacteria are instrumental in regulating and strengthening our immune system instead of making us ill. He also said that bacteria are everywhere, inside us and outside, and that 1/3 of the foods we eat to this day are products of fermentation, such as cheeses, bread, condiments, and many more. Fermentation is one of the most ancient methods of food processing and makes food more stable, more digestible, and more delicious. Even animals know fermentation and pass that wisdom on through millennia, including the flocks of robins that stop by here each January. They enjoy getting drunk on the fermented red berries of the madrone tree outside my window. Sandor Katz is a much-loved and respected author, teacher, and fermented food maker. He earned the nickname of Sandor Kraut, and his mission is to inspire people to practice the arts of fermentation in their kitchens. He spoke at the second annual Heirloom Seed Expo in Santa Rosa, California, in September 2012. This is the question and answer section of his talk. After his introduction into the history of fermentation in part one, he now responds to more practical questions. The first being, if he could please go on some more about yogurt.
Well, okay, so the question was whether I could go on. I could go on. But about a yogurt culture that is not a purchased one. So let me confess that, you know, thanks to the internet, I was able to purchase an heirloom yogurt culture from an outfit called culturesforhealth.com. I actually bought two different heirloom yogurt cultures. One was a Bulgarian yogurt culture and one was a Greek yogurt culture. One was labeled B in my refrigerator and the other one was labeled G. And I kept both of them going for about a year and a half. And then I accidentally ate all of G, so all I have now is B. But I have made about 50 generations out of that yogurt, and you know, really every batch is just as thick and delicious as the last one was, and I have never had any any sense that it was petering out at all, which is what always happens within a couple of generations when I have used a commercial store-bought yogurt as my starter. Okay, so this is a question about how did I get interested in fermentation? What led me into writing about fermentation and teaching about fermentation? Okay, 19 years ago, I moved from New York City to a community in rural Tennessee, and I got involved in keeping a garden. And I was such a naive city kid that it was a shock to me that all of the cabbages were ready at the same time. And I had discovered my love of cooking and making things from scratch. As a kid, I loved sour pickles. Like growing up in New York City, what people in the rest of the country call kosher dills, what we in New York City call sour pickles, it was just like my favorite food as a kid. So I was drawn to that flavor. I'd spent a couple years in my 20s following a macrobiotic diet, and macrobiotics places quite a bit of emphasis on starting your meal with a live pickle as a digestive stimulant. So I started to develop, you know, sort of the idea that they were helpful for digestion. And what I started actually feeling you know, when I would smell them or taste them, I would feel my salivary glands under my tongue, you know, sort of squirting out saliva. And so I really started to, in a very tangible way, experience that these foods got my digestive juices flowing. But it wasn't until I had a garden and suddenly there was all this cabbage and all these radishes that I thought to myself, oh, I should learn how to make sauerkraut. And, you know, I looked in The Joy of Cooking, and I learned how to make sauerkraut from The Joy of Cooking. You know, not the 90s edition, but the 70s edition. And then, you know, I was living in this community, and my sort of community service was, you know, in the garden and in the kitchen, and that sort of afforded me the opportunity to you know, kind of develop an obsession and indulge my obsession. And then friends at another community in Tennessee, the Sequatchie Valley Institute, invited me in 1999. They were having a, you know, remember how everyone was all freaked out about Y2K, everything was going to end, you know, on New Year's Day in 2000, and everyone was like, you know, storehousing all this food. So, you know, so they organized this event called Food for Life in the New Millennium, like, you know, sort of food skill sharing, and they invited me to come teach a sauerkraut making workshop. And in that first sauerkraut making workshop, I really had this feeling of like finding my calling. And what I had never experienced, so what I learned during that workshop, is how much fear there is. Like that, you know, the most common question that I have fielded over the last decade of doing this is, you know, how do I know that I'm going to get the right bacteria growing? How can I be sure that, you know, instead of lactic acid bacteria, I'm not going to get botulism or, you know, E. coli 0157 or salmonella or some other notorious food poisoning organism? And so I enjoyed kind of demystifying fermentation and empowering people. And, you know, one year I missed, they started doing that as an annual event. And in 2001, I spent the summer at my friend's place in Maine, and I was missing this event. And so I wrote a little zine. I self-published a little 16-page zine that was called Wild Fermentation, a do-it-yourself guide to cultural manipulation. And that's still floating around, copies of that zine. But then as soon as I wrote it, I was like, oh, this is something that needs a book, and I've always wanted to be a writer. This is what I can write about. So that led me into writing Wild Fermentation and teaching. But just so you know, according to this friend that I've made who's a microbiologist at the USDA, there never has been a single case of food poisoning reported in the United States from fermented vegetables. And there are very few foods that you could say that about. I mean, you can't say that about raw vegetables, right? I mean, you know, we hear every year about, you know, lettuce, spinach, tomatoes, you know, one thing after another. And there's always the possibility of incidental contamination. I mean, it could just be from some sloppy person's fingers, but really more likely it's from the, you know, runoff of the manure from the factory farm uphill. I mean, that's how most of these, you know, sort of scandals that we read about happen. But if you took vegetables that had been exposed to some sort of incidental contamination like that and made sauerkraut out of them, the indigenous lactic acid bacteria would overwhelm the incidental contaminants, and as it acidified, it would destroy them. And that's why nobody ever gets sick from sauerkraut. It's not that everybody always washes their hands perfectly before they make sauerkraut. It's not that the vegetables never, you know, have been exposed to manure running down the hill. You know, it's just that it has this built-in safety mechanism. So, okay, I guess that answers your question.
That is Sandor Katz. The next person asks about strategies of fermenting in hot weather.
Sure. I mean, I live in Tennessee. What you have to understand is that the metabolism of all the microorganisms gets faster when it gets hotter, slower when it gets cooler. So if you want to make things like, you know, sauerkraut, or really any kind of ferment in hot weather, it's just going to go a lot faster. So you need to think about fermenting it for a much shorter period of time. I also like to think about my house in terms of microclimates. So I have a sense in my house, like if I want something to be warmer, I put it on top of the refrigerator because the refrigerator generates heat. And so that's an extra warm microclimate. If I want something to be cooler, then I put it in a low corner where it's not going to get light. And when the heat rises, the heat is going to rise away from it. So, you know, but that's just a couple of degrees, you know, at the margins. I mean, you just have to adjust. I mean, people who have fermentation businesses and are making their commercial products in a non-controlled environment, they have to continually adjust as the seasons change how long their fermentation period is. I mean, if you make kombucha and in the wintertime, you know, it takes, it takes 10 days. In the summertime, it might only take 6 or 7 days, depending on what the temperature is. So you know, you have to be flexible and trust your senses. Taste things frequently to get a sense of how they're doing. And then certain things you just can't necessarily make all year around. Like if you're going to try making salami, other than a temperature controlled environment, you have to just do it in the right season. You can't necessarily make any food any time of the year. You know, these things all evolved out of, particular, environmental conditions. And while we certainly have lots of ways that we can manipulate environmental conditions to, extend the seasons, you just can't necessarily make everything all the time. Okay. Okay, so are you talking about milk kefir grains? Okay, so kefir grains, one of my very favorite things to talk about. I love kefir grains. I couldn't love them more. Kefir is extraordinary. Like if you've never seen kefir grains, like check them out. They're these like rubbery blobs that host an extraordinarily complex community. The biologist Lynn Margulis, who just died a few months ago, wrote an extraordinary essay called From Kefir to Death. Evolutionary biologists are fascinated by kefir. Lynn Margulis identified 30 distinct microorganisms that are part of this community. That they coordinate their reproduction, they spin this skin which they share, and she wrote about it as a model for what she calls symbiogenesis, the idea that it's the symbiosis between microorganisms that is the engine of evolutionary change. But the reason why evolutionary biologists are fascinated by this is an example of a life form that has evolved just in the time that people have domesticated lactating animals for their milk. Because, even though, milk has existed as long as mammals have existed, it's only when humans started domesticating animals and collecting their milk that milk ever existed in a vessel that something could start to live in. So kefir grains are fascinating. It's very, very different from yogurt. It's never solid. It's always liquid. And in this complex community of 30-some microorganisms is yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And what's significant about that is that yeast ferments lactose into alcohol. So kefir is lightly alcoholic. Because it's lightly alcoholic, and if you do it sealed in a vessel, it's bubbly. One of its nicknames is the champagne of milks. One of the things I love about it, I mean, as much as I love yogurt, kefir is so easy. Yogurt involves all this temperature manipulation. You heat it up, you cool it down, you have to incubate it at about 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And I mean, it's not that hard. I mean, I have a little ritual when I do it, and I love it. But kefir is just so simple. Like you pour the milk over the grains, shake it a couple times, leave it on the counter at room temperature for 1 day, 2 days, maybe 3 days, depending on the temperature and how strong of a flavor you like. And then just enjoy it. They're distinctive processes that come from distinctive parts of the world. They both have migrated far from their original range, but kefir is incredibly easy. The only hard part is finding the kefir grains.
A woman asks, can you ferment coconut?
Sure. I mean, there is no food that you cannot ferment. Some ways that I have fermented coconut, or I have seen people ferment coconut. Well, first of all, in Sri Lanka, they make this amazing coconut and rice pancakes that they call hoppers. I mean, I've never been to Sri Lanka. You know, my pen pal in Sri Lanka was a little bit horrified, you know, that I made flat pancakes out of it, because they use like a special pan that's shaped like a wok. I'm never very good at, you know, sort of doing things completely authentically. So hoppers is one way. I mean, certainly with water kefir grains, which are not the same as the kefir grains I was just talking about. Kefir grains are these, they look something like florets of cauliflower, like lots of surface area, rounded, white, rubbery blobs. Water kefir grains are these angular, more translucent little grains. All of these cultures that evolve into a distinctive physical form, including kombucha, these are generally referred to as SCOBYs, S-C-O-B-Y, symbiotic communities of bacteria and yeast. But water kefir works beautifully in coconut water or with coconut milk. I have put coconuts into kimchi and sauerkraut. You know, mature white flesh of it into those things. Also in the Philippines, they make a candy that's called nata de coco. And it's basically, they make coconut vinegar out of sweetened coconut water. And then the mother that forms on top of that, they remove these sheets of the mother of vinegar, which is very similar to the mother of kombucha. And then they boil those in a simple syrup and make a candy out of it. And you can do that with kombucha mothers. And in my new book, in the Art of Fermentation, I talk about how to do that with a kombucha mother. So there's lots of different things you can do to ferment a coconut. And really, like, there is no food that you cannot ferment.
This is a question about making yogurt with raw milk and getting pink mold after 1 week.
So this is in the fridge, it develops this? Well, I mean, one thing I could suggest is to, you know, eat it up faster than that and use it. I will say that I don't have a lot of experience with raw milk cow yogurt. I've played around a bit with raw milk goat yogurt, and I've done research about it too. But you know, one of the rationales for the superiority of raw milk is that pasteurizing it denatures proteins. The reason why yogurt becomes solid is because the proteins are denatured, and so they can be restructured by the bacteria. So I actually mostly don't make raw milk yogurt. I heat up my milk to about 180 degrees, hold it there for a couple of minutes, then cool it down to 110 to 115 and add the cultures. With raw milk yogurt, you have the additional issue of the cream rising to the top, so it doesn't remain unified. But as for the pink mold growing on it, I can't really explain it, but I can just tell you in general, if you ever get bright colored molds growing on your food, throw them out. Don't just scrape them off the top. Like, you know, discard the food that has the bright colored mold growing on it. Bright colored molds can be extremely dangerous. White molds are really benign. In a lot of traditions, people just mix the white mold that develops on the surface of things right back in. I generally scrape them off and discard them, but in a lot of traditions, they just mix them right back in. And, you know, I keep waiting to hear one story of somebody who says, like, you know, their friend with extreme mycosensitivities got sick from their sauerkraut that it had mold growing on it. And I have yet to hear a single story like that. So my conclusion is that, you know, really they are safe for everyone. But pink molds, like I definitely would not eat mold that had pink mold growing on it.
How about green?
Green blue molds are a little bit more, I have scraped off green blue molds. And then I also have had mycologists tell me that that's a foolish thing to do. Okay, in the corner there. Okay, so the question is about the kombucha craze, and do I see any other, you know, sort of ferments becoming, you know, that popular? I love kombucha. Just on my way in here, somebody handed me beautiful kombucha. I'm loving it. It's refreshing and fortifying. But my perspective is that kombucha is not a unique superfood. You know, live culture foods and beverages are extremely beneficial to us. most significantly because they can, you know, help to replenish and diversify bacterial populations in our guts. But the more different kinds of fermented foods you can eat, the more stimulation you are going to receive. By deciding that one food is the food, you are doing yourself a disservice. Eat different kinds of fermented foods. Enjoy kombucha, but also enjoy sauerkraut. And kombucha is one of a broad category. Like I wrote a chapter in my new book called Sour Tonic Beverages. And so, you know, if you're from the Caribbean, you're familiar with a beverage called Mabi. If you're from Russia, you're familiar with a beverage called Kvass. If you're from Mexico, you're familiar with a beverage called Tepache. But the world is full of these beautiful, lightly fermented beverages that are just densely populated with live cultures. And kombucha is one of them, but it is by no means unique. And it, you know, it is my fervent hope that you know, more of these different kinds of lightly fermented beverages gain the same kind of popularity that kombucha has. And that just brings me to what I would like to end with, which is the other connotation of the word fermentation. So, you know, fermentation is not just the transformative action of microorganisms. The word fermentation actually comes from Latin fervere, which means to boil. And it's because the visible action of fermenting liquids is bubbles. And that's the same as the visible action of boiling liquids. But we also use the word fermentation. If you read the news, you'll read about political ferment, cultural ferment, social ferment. I even saw a reference recently to spiritual ferment. But that's basically when people get bubbly, when people get excited, when people have like an irrepressible you know, desire to talk about what's exciting them, what's animating them. You know, that's when you get a period of you know, of social ferment. You know, when people start to believe in change, and they, you know, it's all they want to talk about, and that excitement spreads. You know, that so really fermentation becomes the engine of social change. So I guess I would like to I'll wrap up my remarks now just with that thought that, you know, fermentation is a lot bigger than these, you know, wonderful, you know, delicacies that are created by microorganisms, and that, you know, if we want to come together and, you know, and change our food systems and change, you know, other aspects of our society, that you know, we are participating, you know, almost as bacteria. And an individual bacterium can never do anything transformative, but it's by sort of, you know, coming together and becoming, you know, it is the coming together that enables them to become a force, and it is the coming together that enables us to become a force. So I'm going to go outside and I'll be at this table.
A standing ovation for Sandor Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation. He spoke at the second annual Heirloom Seed Expo on September 13, 2012, in Santa Rosa, California. Get to know him better and find out how exactly to make fermented foods by visiting his website, www.wildfermentation.com. This website is focused on practice, filled with illustrated recipes, some sent to the blog from across the world, many by Sandor Katz. He's generous about his sources and the teachers he's indebted to. Sandor also travels a lot, teaching workshops in venues ranging from country fairs to professional conferences. As in so many other areas of gardening, farming, and seed collecting, the whole tradition and popular wisdom of fermentation was just about to be lost under the impact of global corporate and industrial foods. So anybody reclaiming local wisdom or moving towards self-reliance can find inspiration in fermentation. Sandor writes on his website, wildfermentation.com, wild foods, microbial cultures included, possess a great unmediated life force, which can help us adapt to shifting conditions and lower our susceptibility to disease. These microorganisms are everywhere, and the techniques for fermenting with them are simple and flexible. These are ancient rituals that humans have been performing for many generations. They connect us to the magic of the natural world and to our ancestors. By eating a variety of live fermented foods, you promote diversity among microbial cultures inside your body. Your environment becomes you as you invite the microbes you share with the earth. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. There you can also find the link to the website of Sandor Katz, wildfermentation.com, and a recipe for sauerkraut. TUC Radio is produced in Northern California off the electric grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD or a film on DVD with Sandor Katz by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and on the web, and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation, CD or DVD order, keep this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD or DVD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. On that website, you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. Time of useful consciousness. Three of my most favorite words. Coming up on TUC Radio, a report on the conference Our Common Future Under Climate Change. In the early days of July 2015, 2,000 speakers came to Paris. Many of them were scientists from nearly 100 countries. They discussed the physical, economic, and social aspects of climate change. The conference hoped to inspire ambition for a global climate treaty later this year at the COP21 climate conference, especially in light of the disappointing outcome of all climate conferences in the past. Some prominent conference speakers stated matter-of-factly that we need not just reduce, but actually end the carbon-based economy that relies on oil, coal, and gas within the next 2 decades, which may be the greatest challenge humanity ever faced. Countries have agreed that Paris in 2015 is the time and place to finally sign an international treaty requiring all nations to begin reducing carbon emissions by 2020. The stated goal of living in a post-carbon world is the challenge and opportunity we face together. Coming up on TUC Radio. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.